Last week saw the bombshell finale of the HBO documentary series The Jinx, director Andrew Jarecki's inquiry into three probable murders and their elusive suspect, Robert Durst. Spoiler alert, the next few minutes will reveal more than some may wish to hear, beginning with the climax to end all climaxes. It was the film's subject in a bathroom, unaware he was being recorded, apparently confessing.
What the hell did I eat? Kill them all. Of course.
What the hell did I do? Durst muttered. Kill them all, of course. It was a stunning denouement to six episodes of some truly gripping television, what one commentator called the true crime series we've all been waiting for. Even before it aired on Monday, Durst, the squirrely New York real estate heir, was under arrest for murder. But soon, the search for deception and manipulation shifted from the film's subject to the filmmakers themselves. Much has been made of the final confrontation between Jarecki and his subject, when Durst is asked to compare a note he wrote to one of the murder victims with an anonymous letter sent to the Beverly Hills police. They are in identical block letters, and both add an extraneous E to Beverly. And Durst knows the implications.
Well, I mean, the writing looks similar, and the spelling is the same, so I can see the conclusion the cops would draw. Or the writing exemplar person would conclude they were both written by the same person.
That breathtaking moment is triumphant partly because the filmmakers have spent much of the final episode struggling on camera to get Durst to sit in for that final interview. Then, providentially, Durst calls them at his lawyer's behest. They're seeking some raw footage that might help Durst be to charge of stalking his hated younger brother, and Jarecki thinks he's regained the upper hand.
They're saying, Bob, if you don't want to go to jail and you want to have a good defense here, you need Jarecki and Smerling to give you the defense. Obviously gives us a lot of leverage.
Thing is, the leverage, Durst's arrest for violating a restraining order, took place more than a year after the crucial interview. That is, after Durst faced the damning evidence and wandered obliviously to the men's room in a cold sweat with a hot mic. And what of the months that elapsed before the producers informed police of the apparently incriminating letter, and the 2 years that elapsed before they claimed to have accidentally discovered the accidental bathroom bonanza? And yet, Durst's arrest came propitiously on the eve of the finale. By Tuesday, the filmmakers had canceled scheduled media interviews and also declined our request to appear, explaining they don't wish to interfere with the ongoing prosecution. But the issues of documentary ethics do not begin nor end with The Jinx. Joe Berlinger, with his late collaborator Bruce Sanofsky, directed a previous HBO true crime documentary, the acclaimed Paradise Lost trilogy. It also chronicled three murders: the gruesome 1993 killings of three little boys in what was thought to be a satanic ritual. The trilogy ultimately secured the release of three West Memphis, Arkansas young men wrongfully convicted of the crime. Berlinger says that the pressure is constantly on filmmakers to wring out the maximum drama and suspense from inherently confusing events.
You know, when you do things like stylized recreations of gruesome events for the participants who live them, when you put yourself on camera, as many filmmakers do, as the crusading investigator. You know, I get notes from networks all the time about upping the entertainment value, upping the suspense. And, you know, real life doesn't naturally fit a conventional dramatic arc. And we, as makers of this kind of work, are under increasing pressure to conform to the conventions of scripted television. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It just makes it a very interesting time for documentary.
And it's the very techniques, the ones you just enumerated, that inflate the drama, but also, upon any reflection, would tend to diminish trust in the filmmakers themselves.
I think there's a larger issue here. I mean, first of all, I believe that all filmmaking, all media is inherently subjective. Just the process of whittling your footage down is a series of decisions. How you choose to frame your shot, you low angle, you know, suggests one thing, a high angle suggests another.
In fact, in Paradise Lost, there's this one moment where you capture the stepfather of one of the victims, a guy who is a part-time clergyman. And there's a shadow of one of the pieces of, I think, of recording equipment on his forehead that looks very much like a pentagram. And, you know, it's to gasp to see that, especially as the story plays out.
Well, I mean, that was a true found moment. It was around Christmas time. They were putting a miniature Christmas tree on the grave of their newly deceased son. And because of the angle of the sun and the angle of the head of that stepfather, it reversed the image of the star that was on top of the Christmas tree to being an upside-down star, which is what a satanic pentagram is. It was a chilling moment to observe and a chilling moment in the film.
Your style of filmmaking is to simply let the camera do the talking. You have no audio narration. Every now and then you insert a title card to set time and place, a little bit of context, especially when there's been quite a bit of elapsed time. But you do show up in the film Paradise Lost. That is in the form of a conversation where a possible murder weapon is being examined in court, and the source of the murder weapon was you guys.
At the grave of the deceased son of one of the stepfathers, we were given a knife by him as a present, which was an unusual present to give, on Christmas Eve. And when we went back to our hotel room, we opened that knife up, and there was blood in the hinge, and it was a serrated knife. And these children had multiple stab wounds on them that were consistent with a serrated knife. And so we were confronted with a serious ethical dilemma. You know, was this potentially a piece of evidence? What do we do? Do we violate this relationship that we have with our subject by turning this knife over? What would that mean for the film? You know, we felt that if we turned this knife over, it would undoubtedly shut the film down because the filmmaker-subject relationship is so important in gaining and maintaining access that we felt that this would really be kind of the death knell of our project. Within 24 hours, we were back in New York, meeting with various executives and legal representatives at HBO, and collectively we made the decision that good citizenship trumps any filmmaking need, that doing the right thing was more important than our film project, and that if we had come into possession of a potential piece of evidence, we had a moral obligation to turn it over.
And yet the filming continued. You took your project to fruition, and then in two subsequent installments. How did the fact that you became a participant in the investigation alter the filmmaking process?
The first film was purely an exercise in cinema. You know, we came to film a story as it was unfolding. And because we thought we had witnessed this incredible miscarriage of justice, we assumed that the first film was going to have a major impact on the case. And when the film was ignored by the authorities and the outcry was ignored by the authorities in Arkansas, we felt we had a duty to make a second and a third film. And that's when we passed from, I think, neutral filmmakers to advocates. And the second and third films are, I think, pieces of advocacy, where the first film, I think, is a piece of journalism. And that's the difference.
How much directorial license have you to fiddle with sequence of chronology and to exclude certain complicating facts in order to make the story more understandable, more seamless, and more powerful?
Any documentary is a compression of time. You know, presenting a 6-week murder trial in Paradise Lost in a 2.5-hour film is a compression of time, which is by definition a manipulation of chronology. That's a given. But what is not acceptable, in my opinion, is overtly telling an audience that something happened on this date when in fact it happened on another date. And so it's a delicate dance, but that's the difference between a good documentary and a bad documentary. There's a fine line between exploitation and investigation, and you always have to be aware not to tip into the exploitation part of the equation.
We discussed the scene where the star on the top of the Christmas tree at the gravesite cast a shadow of a pentagram on the head of one of the grieving step parents. And an hour and a half later, you come to realize that, holy moly, I think this guy might be the killer. Did you withhold anything from the audience for the sake of the ensuing drama?
If you're asking me, do documentarians and do I selectively withhold information until the right dramatic moment, the answer is yes, because you can't present every moment at the moment it happens, because mathematically you can't show your entire story at one moment. There is a thing called running time of a movie that you have to fill. You have to thread the needle in such a way that you keep your audience and that you have an unfolding narrative. I mean, that's called filmmaking.
So on the subject of unfolding narrative, when Andrew Jarecki unfolded the probably incriminating evidence of a Robert Durst penned envelope next to an apparently Robert Durst penned letter to the Beverly Hills police, which would have made him, in his own words, the only possible killer. That happened a couple years earlier than we were perhaps led to believe. Did that, as a filmmaker, make you squeamish?
Good question. I am not in favor of giving false information to an audience for obvious reasons, but I am okay with holding off giving information until the right dramatic moment, because that is the nature of storytelling.
If I haven't misheard you, there is a structural conflict between the role of a documentarian to seek truth and his responsibilities as a filmmaker to spin out the most compelling narrative. Is it possible to do both to the utmost at the same time?
A documentarian must be committed to a truthful presentation of the facts. But in my book, emotional truthfulness is a valid form of truthfulness. You want to give the emotional truth of a situation. Chronology gets manipulated by the act of filmmaking. It doesn't mean you can overtly manipulate chronology. A documentary needs to have balance, but it doesn't mean you need to put every fact and to counterpoint every fact, because then the film would be endless. It's a series of decisions. And I think what separates good documentaries from bad documentaries is finding that balance between truthfulness and storytelling.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Berlinger is a filmmaker, most recently of Whitey, The United States of America versus James Bulger. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovic, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman and Julia Hsu. And our show was edited by, this week, executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.